for this morning. So I'm going to, I made a visual just to help us kind of flow through things a little bit and to highlight the top priority stuff here, because I want to try if we can to finish this section of James. This is in James 1, and we're looking at verses 13 through 15. And I titled this originally, you know, the temptation and trials. But as I was thinking about the essence of this, like the core of what's going on here, because this passage is such an important passage for our theology of sin, that what it really reminded me of, and there's a lot of ways that we'll look at it later. It's been called the biography, the fool's biography. It's been called other things, but the detail that James gets into here, in terms of slicing down the individual steps of what happens from going from temptation to the end point, which is spiritual death and eternal death, really. That, to me, as one who's always been interested in biology and in particularly microbiology, and I couldn't help it. This felt like it was a pathology. It was like he was giving us a pathology of temptation and a pathology of sin. And so I thought, like, you know, let's look at this that way a little bit as we go through it. But what we saw before is we saw that this is basically he's moving out of of looking at trials, and you remember his readers were experiencing hardship and oppression and trials, particularly in the form of being poor and having the rich upper class around them oppressing them, and so it was life was very difficult. This isn't kind of like the typical, you know, the 1% aren't paying their fair share to me, the upper middle class. It's not that. It was the dirt poor barely can hold on are being literally oppressed by the elites of the day. And so life was hard. And that was mixed in with a lot of other things that were going on. And so what James does is he uses that verbal link in the word between this word pyrazo, which is where we get the word for trial. And we also get the word for temptation or to be tempted. It's the same word. And so he uses the ambiguity between sometimes it can mean a trial, which is an external thing, external pressure, when the pressure cooker comes on you because of life. And then he also uses the ambiguity of the fact that that word can also mean this internal temptation towards things that don't please God. And he uses that to really good effect in this passage. And he purposefully brings out the ambiguity of this word. Because the reality is that whenever you're going through trials, whenever things are getting hard in life, those hardships come with their own kind of temptations. It's not like we can easily slice this down and go, well, this is obviously a trial. There's nothing tempting about it, right? There's nothing that's going to come up in your heart or you won't. There's no way for you to possibly take this hardship and make bad decisions from it, right? Every time you have a hardship, every time you will come across opportunities to either glorify God by responding in the right way, or to displease the Lord and to dishonor the Lord and to sin by responding the wrong way. And it's like, how do you parse that? That's what James is getting at. Because basically what was happening was that his readers were going through hardships, they were going through these trials and these oppressions that were happening, and they were making a false allegation against God. That the reason why I am doing the things that I'm doing, the reason why I am struggling is because God is tempting me. I'm struggling because of God, is what they're saying. It's not saying I'm suffering because of God. No, I'm struggling against sin because of God. That's what they're saying. And that's what James wants to address. We have to set the record straight about God. And this happens. This happens. I mean, when you think about the temptation to say, I would not be struggling with this if God did not put this thing in my life. If God didn't, this wouldn't be an issue. But God put this in here, and now it's an issue. And so God he's giving me this temptation. Because I wouldn't have the temptation otherwise if it weren't for him putting me in this circumstance, right? That's that, and you just fill in the blank of what the temptation is. And this is a temptation, as Paul says, that is common to man. The temptation to blame God for the things that we desire to do that we shouldn't. It's a common to man. And when the heat gets turned up in life, these kind of temptations, even the temptations that we don't know are there, kind of rise to the surface because we're looking for ways out. When you turn up the heat and you're in the pot, you start figuring out how do I get out of the pot? And when you can't figure out how to get out of the pot and you get desperate and you're trying to get things and you can't have them because this thing is in the way called suffering, you start to look at God and you say, God is the one that is giving me these feelings. He's giving me these temptations to sin. He's wanting me. He's putting this in my life so that I'd be tempted. And that's where James is going, okay, we have to set the record straight about what's really going on in your trial with your sin and with your temptation. And so he says in verse 13, let no one say when he is tempted, or I remember I talked about the fact that that's that word pyrazo, we could say, let no one say when he is undergoing a trial. Either way. And this is kind of that transition where he's moving from trial to temptation. But in the midst of the trial, let no one say, I am being tempted by God, it says. What's the reason? So the allegation, let me keep going here. Why can't you say that? Well, it has to do with the nature of God. And he really brings up two aspects. And this is all review here. He says, for one, that this is absolutely contrary to the nature of God. God cannot be tempted, he says. He says, let no one say when he's tempted, I'm being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil. He is incapable of it. His holiness precludes it. He can't. It's contrary to his nature. And it is contrary to his actions. He tempts no one. Because he can't be tempted, he by nature can't then go and do that which he abhors, which is impart temptation with the desire. And remember what I said, that temptation means, I don't know why that happened, temptation means to induce a person to sin. To induce a person to sin. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about temptation. Induce a person or entice someone to do an action or a thought, a speech, an action that is contrary to God's nature. So if God can't be tempted to do that himself, to go contrary to his nature, then he certainly will never tempt anyone, inducing them to do that which he abhors. In other words, you really have to believe that if God is for us, who can be against us? But if God is tempting us, then he's certainly not, what, for us. And now you're running up against an understanding of God that is very, very dangerous. And we'll start to look at that next week when we get into verses 16 through 18. Because when we come down to it, everything that what we believe about God is the most important thing about us. What comes to our mind when we think about who he is the most important thing about us. That's what A.W. Tozer reminded us of in the beginning of his book, The Knowledge of the Holy. It's you, you know, you're the most important thing about you is what you believe about God. And if you believe that he can tempt you to evil, that will define you. It will make you a perpetual victim, incapable and just powerless, because if God is trying to get you to sin, then you don't have any hope. And you can't trust him either, right? If he's telling you, don't sin, be holy, for I am holy, and now here I'm going to try to entice you to not be holy, that's not a trustworthy God. So this is about the character and the nature of God here. And that's why he's wanting us to understand. Yeah, I'm not sure why it keeps like quitting out of PowerPoint, but we'll have to figure that out at a different time. All right. Well, it was a nice thought. But we have our handout. And does anybody not have this handout? Okay. There might be a few more up here. But in verse 14, we get into the true source of temptation, okay? So we've kind of seen the false source, which is this false allegation. God's the source of temptation. And you go, no, here's where it really comes from. Verse 14. But each person, he says, each person, and that's a really important way to put it, because he's making this very individual. He's not making it based on a group, on a church, or any. He's going, every single one of you is responsible for yourself, for your actions, for your thoughts, for your words, for your desires. You are accountable on your own for this. You can have nobody be your fallout. Each person, he says, is tempted, okay, there's our word, when he's lured and enticed by his own desire. That is the a foundational truth about the nature of sin in our lives that we really need to understand, that we cannot look outward for sin. We can't look externally outside ourselves. And this is what people like to do. And we like to do it too, right? We like to look outside and we like to kind of say, like, I would not have done this if it wasn't for X, Y, or Z. Like, it's my environment. You know, I grew up in this neighborhood and this neighborhood had an influence on me, and therefore, you know, I did what I did because of my environment or my friend group. And, you know, that's an important consideration, because when you think about Psalm 1, I just read this with my family the other night. I mean, Psalm 1 is all about who is speaking into your life, right? Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, stand in the path of sinners, sit in the seat of scoffers. This is the world, right? And the influence that the world has on you, but rather that person's, that blessed man is blessed because his delight is in Yahweh's law, and he meditates on Yahweh's law day and night, and that leads to productivity and just this fruitful, productive life. That's contrasted with the wicked who are like chaff blowing away, who are going to be burned up in the fire, and God does not know them. He does not know their way, but he knows the way of the righteous. And the whole psalm is about just understanding who is speaking into your life. Is God speaking into your life? Is he the one that is informing you about how to think, about how to live, or is it the world? So obviously there are factors to play in what we're listening to, right? If you listen to the world, if you listen to ungodly counsel, of course it's going to lead down a wrong road. But ultimately, what James is saying is you can't even blame the counsel, because you can hear it. But if you remember the foolish decisions that Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, made, you know, Solomon came to an end, and then Rehoboam, his son, came on the scene as the next king of Judah, and he had older counselors, and then he had these younger counselors. And everybody, you know, Solomon, for as much as he did, and obviously he lived a pretty scandalous life, and then kind of came to his senses near the end of his life, and you see that reflected in Ecclesiastes and such, but he also had some amazing building projects. I mean, he built the temple and he built the palace and all of this and did lots and lots of other things. Well, as we know, even from our government projects, that building projects cost what? Money. And where do you get the money from? Oh, yeah. Lots and lots of taxes. And so everybody's bending under the burden of all of these taxes from all of these building projects that Solomon had. And so when Rehoboam comes along, everybody's hoping, okay, all these projects are done. Can we have a break here? Can we have a break? And so the council, his older counselors are going, yeah, you need to give the people a break. The younger counselors, on the other hand, said, No, you need to show them who's boss. And he listened to his younger counselors, and he said, you know, if I can't remember how he put it, but it was something like to the effect of, you know, his little fingers. I can't. There was something about that where it's just like his hold on them was going to be. His little finger is going to be heavier than his father's thigh, or something like that. I mean, it's kind of strange. I wouldn't talk that way. That's weird. But the point that he was trying to make is that I'll show you who's boss. I'll show you who's in charge. And then he, instead of letting off the gas, he just goes, and he just puts it all the way down to the floor. And what happens, that providentially leads the way for Jeroboam to come, and we have a split because of foolish decisions, listening to foolish young counselors rather than the older, wiser counselors who understand human nature and you can't do that. But ultimately, you could say, like, well, he made that decision because of his counselors. Who's to blame for his decisions? He is. He made them. So no matter who's talking into his life, ultimately it comes down to he made a decision. He decided. That's how we have to think. I don't know why I'm pointing up there. It's how we have to think about the forest in Northern California. We have to think about temptation that way. It's our problem. It is not on the outside. It is not circumstantial. Temptation does not come from outside of us. It comes from inside of us. And you go, wait a minute. I know what you're thinking. What do you think I'm thinking? What about the devil, the tempter? And we'll talk about that a little bit more. Obviously, like, there is external temptation that can come along. But can the devil really make you do it? Okay? So there is external temptation that can come, but James is still getting at the point, is that the temptation, all the devil is doing as the tempter, taking on the role of the tempter, is enticing you. He's enticing you to act upon your inner desires. This is the nature of the temptations that Jesus underwent. He's trying to get Jesus' human desires, desire for food and rest, desire that he even has rightfully as the King of Kings and Lords of Lords. All you have to do is just bow down to me. All you have to do is just circumvent the plan, and you can have it all now. But that didn't make Jesus sin. He didn't struggle with the inner desire that the desire overcame, okay? But the temptation came from outside, but the temptation was a temptation to act upon an inner desire. And that's where James is getting at. He says, each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. D. Edmund Hebert said, by his own evil desires names the true source of man's temptation. God is not to be blamed, for the trouble lies in the, I love this, the combustible material that each man carries within himself. Temptation has its source not in the outer lure, but in the inner lust. The inner lust. His own desires. The desire, this is the word epithumia. And oftentimes, and in older translations, it's translated as lust. I think that most more modern translations avoid that word because what is lust usually connected with in English? Yeah, sexual sin, right? So because of that, I think they've tried to make it clear that these desires aren't just around sexual lust, which is what we tend to think about when we think about that word. And so there, but it's the same word. And oftentimes it is talking in the context of when that word is used in other places. Epithumia can literally mean sexual desires. But in this case, it's not. It's broader than that. It's any desire that you have that is contrary to God's will for your life. Any desire. And so because of that, it's as broad as you can get. But look at the, and you could also, I'm tempted to go, I just don't want to, no, we won't go. I'll let you look at it on your own. This would be good homework. Romans 7, because this is like the sinner's biography there with what Paul is talking about. He uncovers and just goes into the individual detail about the struggle that goes on in the heart, right? As God's law and God's truth comes into play, that excites within him these desires that he didn't even know he had. But it's like opening up a room in that you didn't even know you had in the basement. Just like, and it's filled with things, filled with desires. This room in your heart that you didn't know you had, but as soon as you open it up, those desires start coming out. And that's what he's talking about. They're coming from the heart, but they're in his words, lured and enticed, he says. Each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. And this is interesting. This is interesting. I wish I had the whiteboard, but I don't think there's any markers on it anyway. But this is coming kind of from the world of the hunting and fishing world. Okay? I love to fish. I used to hunt a little bit. Don't have the opportunity to do much anymore, but I still like to fish. And with fishing, like, what are you really doing? Especially like you're taking a hook, right? You're putting what on it? Yeah, bait. It's something, it's attractive. Sometimes there's a smell to it or whatever. If you're using live bait or you're using eggs or something like that, sometimes it just looks like something, you know, it's a bead. It just looks like a salmon egg, but it's just a little plastic bead or whatever, or it's a lure that looks like a fish, but it's got a hook on the end. And you're using this and it looks like something desirable, right? He's not getting technical in this, all right? So you kind of have to use your imagination. He's not trying to write a scientific thesis on the subject. Nor is he trying to teach you how to fish. All he's trying to do is use these words that are kind of in the milieu of the Koine Greek world and the Hellenistic world. But it even goes, like, these are words that appear in other Jewish literature in the Hellenistic period. So it was a common way to talk about temptation, okay? But it still comes from the fishing and the hunting world where you have this thing. It's the temptation is like this lure that is acting upon the desire that you have in your heart. So it's this thing that you want. It is your desire. And temptation is this lure that lures you out and entices your inner desires to come out so that you can act upon them. Just like that when I go fly fishing on the Kenai, and every once in a while I've had a chance to go on a boat, and you see the perfect place, you know. There's some overhanging branches, and you're like, there's got to be fish in there. If I can just get my bead over there and just let it drift right in front, I bet you that is enough for some fish who wants to eat, right, desire, to be lured out and enticed into biting. I mean, that's the idea there.
Do fish have an evil nature?
But that's how it works. So when you think about it, you have your own desires. You have stuff going on in your heart. You have wants. You have needs, but sometimes those needs can turn into lustful desires, to desire things that you don't need to have and you don't want, but it's based on a need, but it goes beyond that. And that's the reason Paul said the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil, right? It's not that, I mean, you can't really survive without money, but can the desire to have money to survive become an evil desire? Can the normal base desire to make a living go south? Absolutely. So even a healthy desire can turn evil. If it's used for wrong motives, if it's used the means by which you get it is wrong, so all sorts of permutations off of that. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about these things that are in our hearts, and then temptation comes along sometimes just in the externals of life, and that desire is awakened, and it zeroes in, and it's lured and enticed out. Strike. And that's the pathology here. It starts in the heart. It starts in the heart.
this note you got on Matthew 6:13.
Yeah.
Am I jumping ahead?
Well, we're just about to get there. Yeah, I was going to.
That's really interesting.
Well, yeah, and we should turn back there, because this is where I do want to talk about the role of Satan in this. Because Jesus obviously talked about Satan, and even in Matthew 6, I mean, it's a translational and an interpretational question of whether or not he was meaning what he was meaning by this. But obviously he taught his disciples to pray in the Lord's Prayer, and this is a model prayer. It's not obviously intended to just be a rote prayer, but it's a model for how we relate to the Lord and how we pray about all the different aspects, and how we keep our prayers and our mind focused on Godward rather than selfward. You know, we don't really even get in this prayer to ourselves until later on, until in verse 11. But at the beginning, he's talking about his holiness. We're talking about our Father who is in heaven and desiring that he makes his name holy, and he sanctifies his name, hallowed, meaning to sanctify it, to keep it apart and separate and glorified. A desire to see God's will done and God's kingdom come, meaning like we're not satisfied with the here and now. We're desiring a better city. We're desiring a better kingdom than any of the kingdoms of the world. We're not satisfied here. I sense that I'm a foreigner and a sojourner, and I want your will done in my life. So this is all Godward. This is the nature of prayer. When we pray, God is aligning our wills to his will, for us to want what he wants. But he also does recognize that we have needs. And so in verse 11, he says, give us this day our daily bread. Please provide for us the things that we need. We need verse 12 more than anything, forgiveness. And so there's a pathway for confession of sin, the forgiveness of sin here. And in the same way, we have a vertical relationship with the Lord. We also recognize there's a horizontal relationship that is dynamic and needs reconciliation with people. We need to forgive based upon God's forgiveness of us. But then verse 13, this is when it gets into the personal my sin has been forgiven. Forgive us our sins, just as we forgive those who sin against us. And then what about the tomorrow? Lead us not into perosmos, temptation, perosmos. The same word we've been seeing in James 1 in the forest. It's the same word. Lead us not into perosmos, but, and this is in contrast to the don't lead us here, but rather deliver us from evil. But if you have a note at the bottom, that there is an article at the front of that word evil, which means that it could be standing in for evil, or it could be a personification for the evil one, the evil, meaning the evil one, the one who is evil, meaning Satan. And so there is a connection here that Matthew makes, if you would take that understanding of it, that this is, he's referring to deliverance from the evil one as a connection between temptation and Satan. And this is, this would more be the view that I would take in this, is that this is referring to the evil one. He is called he is called the tempter, as we said. In Matthew 4:3, he's called the tempter, coming to tempt Jesus. He's called that same thing in 1 Thessalonians 3:5. But Satan has a role to play. But like I said, he can't make you do anything. He can't force you to sin. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a Savior, because he would have forced Jesus to sin. Every single one of us makes our own decisions in this. Yeah.
Yeah, but he puts evil things on us. I mean, look what he did to Job.
Absolutely. And if Job were to sin in that moment, that would not be because Satan made him, though. That's my point. Right. He can't make you. In the same way, I mean, this goes contrary to what I think what we think about Satan. Satan doesn't know your thoughts either. He's not omniscient. He can't get in your head and know what you're thinking. But he's a good student. And so he's not alone, right? He's not just, he is a created being. He is supernatural, right? So it, you know, he doesn't have to take the train to get places, but he can only be at one place at one time. So Satan's not always with you going, the devil made me do it. Well, the devil's probably maybe somewhere else right now. I'm not sure if you're that important in his grand scheme, but he has a lot of help, right? A third of the angels, it says, Scripture talks about, rebelled with him. He has a lot of minions that are working together in concert to study you, to study us, to understand what our weaknesses are, what our predilections are, to do this, to do that. And we have a whole file on you, Nathan. We know what you like. We know what you don't like. We know what tends to make you react. And because, you know, he's the God of this world, and he is in control of this world system, this whole thing, we can set up life to trigger you based on what we know you're like. We can set stuff up. We can try it, but it's not because we can force you to do it. We can only set the stage. That's what Satan does. This is Satan's role in what we would see as Ephesians 2, when it talks about the biography of the sinner in Ephesians 2. And it says, you were dead in your trespasses and sins in which you once walked, following the course of this world, this cosmos, this world system, right? That's all aligned against God. Following the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that's now working in the sons of disobedience. So Satan has a power. He has an influence. He is the prince of this world. But he doesn't have direct power over you. So you always have agency in this. And that's where James wants you to understand that your agency has to do with understanding and recognizing desire and where desire is coming from and what Satan plays on. Satan can tempt you by playing on your desires. And sometimes they're innate human desires, and sometimes they're unique Nathan desires and Chris desires. And, and it's like he plays off of that. But that's Satan's role. But we can't blame Satan any more than the first man and the first woman tried to blame the serpent, right? Adam tried to blame Eve, and Eve tried to blame the serpent, but neither were forced to do anything. Nobody was going, she wasn't doing this. She saw the fruit, saw that it was desirable for food, and she took, she ate, she gave to her husband. That right there gives you a clue of what James is talking about with desire. She saw, she desired it. It was desirable. And in a way, if we turn back to Proverbs, this is very, very similar to and this is where he's going next, actually. But in Proverbs 7, and really Proverbs 5 through 7, but we'll just look at 7 for a minute. But this is another one of those like biographies of the fool, who is enticed by sin here and foolishness. And foolishness is depicted in chapter 7 as an adulteress, as a prostitute. But it's a stand-in. Like, yes, it is an adulteress, it's a prostitute, but it's a stand-in for the larger look of foolishness, of following after foolishness rather than Lady Wisdom, who is also depicted in the text as a woman. But she is saying, come to me. I will give you wisdom. But listen to this and see if you can see some similarities between what James is talking about with desire and this play here. This is my son. This is verse 1, chapter 7 of Proverbs. Keep my words, treasure up my commandments with you. Verse 2, bind them on your fingers, write them on the tablets of your heart. Say to wisdom, you are my sister. Call insight, your intimate friend. Keep you from the forbidden woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words. And then he starts to kind of talk as if he's just this observer of this foolish young man. At the window of my house, I looked out through the lattice. I've seen among the simple, this is the simple, the open-minded, the one who hasn't learned enough to shut the door. I have perceived among the youths a young man lacking sense, passing along the street near her corner. Okay, so he is passing along the street and he's coming by her. This is where she hangs out. Does he know what he's doing here? Or is he clueless? It's hard to tell, but this is her corner. And if you're from this town, you know she likes to be here. So this is kind of what he's playing off of. In the twilight, in the evening, at the time of night and darkness, the time when evil takes place, under the cloak of darkness. And behold, the woman meets him dressed as a prostitute, wily at heart. She is loud and wayward. Her feet do not stay at home. Now in the street, now in the market, and at every corner she lies in wait. Okay, this is, I mean, you think about it, this she's like that bait. She knows how to lure, how to attract, how to entice with looks and sound. And she's looking, she's praying, she's looking for her victim to come along, someone that she can entice because she knows how they think. She knows what they want. Even if they're not going down that road, even for that reason, she still knows. She seizes him and kisses him. With bold face, she says to him, I have to offer sacrifices today. I have paid my vows, so now I have come out to meet you, to seek you eagerly, and I've found you. There's flattery, right? She's enticing him with her words and flattering him. I've spread my couch with coverings, colored linen from Egyptian linen. I have perfumed my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon. There's the enticement of extravagance and all of the base kind of sense desires, the good smells, the good feelings. Come, let us take our fill of love till morning. Let us delight ourselves with love. For my husband is not at home. He has gone on a long journey. He took a bag of money with him. Full moon, he will come home. Nobody will catch us. We'll just enjoy the fulfillment of gratification. That's the desire. That's the enticement. But it's an enticement on his desire, right? She's playing on him and what she knows he wants. And so, verse 21, with much seductive speech, she persuades him. He could say no, right? He could say no, but she persuades him. Lured and enticed by our own desires. Her smooth talk, she compels him. All at once, he follows her. And then this is where we're going to get into the next verse. Here in James, because this is where James is going. As an ox goes to the slaughter, this is where it leads. He doesn't know. He thinks nothing will happen. He thinks I'll never get caught. He thinks this is not a big deal. So he follows her as an ox goes to the slaughter, or a stag is caught fast till an arrow pierces its liver, as a bird rushes into a snare. He does not know that it will cost him his life. It's powerful stuff. And that's like a living kind of illustration in the Proverbs of the process that James is talking about in James 1. Yes.
Turn aside to her ways.
Yes. I mean, this is, yeah.
The temptation of sin seems very clear to me. Mm-hmm. But I seem to see, and I understand what you said, I believe the word, he cannot tempt us. But at the same time, I can't help but think of those words, I will make you fisher of men.
Oh, gotcha.
So
yeah.
I feel a desire to follow the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And that all has to do with the actual meaning of that word temptation. And temptation is an incitement to do evil. Right, right. It's an incitement to do that which is contrary to God. And so that's where, you know, when God gives you a commandment or places in you a desire, like lean not on your own understanding, but in your heart acknowledge him and he will give you the desires of your heart. He's never going to give you the desires, your evil desires. But what that leaning on your own understanding is basically saying is God's going to work on your heart to desire what he desires so that my desires are his desires and we're aligned. So I'm going to want what he wants for my life. And so he's never going to entice you to rebel. He's going to entice. He doesn't entice. He calls. He commands. He calls. He works on your heart. But he doesn't. This is kind of the deceptive nature of sin and temptation, is that it is how it operates. That's what James is kind of pulling off. Let's finish this verse so we can be done here. But that's a great point. So in verse 15, this verse has been called the fool's biography, by the way, because there's this kind of progression here. Okay, so each person tempted when he's lured, enticed by his own desires, and then here's the progression. Then sin, when it has conceived, gives birth, or sorry, desire when it is conceived gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. And this is why it's called the biography here, because there's actually three generations that are in view, and it starts with desire. Each the desire here is almost, it's depicted, and this is why I went to Proverbs 7, because Proverbs 7 is a picture of a prostitute, right? And the language of this text almost depicts desire in the same way. The way it's talked about, it's almost like its desire is being portrayed as a woman who conceives. And so at the conception of desire and temptation, when you were lured out and enticed by that own desire, it starts with a desire, right? It starts with a desire, and you can kill the desire if you want. You can put to death the members of your flesh which wage war against you. You can do that, or you can give in to the desire at the point of temptation. But it's the temptation that lures out your desire, and at that point, desire is like a woman who conceives in that moment. It's like there's a uniting of temptation and desire, and conceives and gives birth to what? To sin. Which means that while the desire is there, you're one step, you're one generation removed from the sin. But as soon as that you bring together the temptation and the desire, and you give into it, it gives birth to sin. Desire's baby is sin, all right? And then he gets he goes another step, and he goes, okay, you take that sin, and if you don't deal with it, if you don't kill it there, if you just let it continue to grow and continue to get bigger and bigger and grow. And finally, he says, in sin, when it is fully grown, when it is brought to completion in the Greek, when it is, you know, it is all the way grown up, and you've just let it live, you haven't dealt with it early, you've let it be a habit in your life, you've not dealt with it, what happens? Sin, when fully grown, brings forth another word for giving birth, bringing forth, and it's going to be used in the next verse 18. He brought us forth by the living. So this is another kind of birthing term. It brings forth death. You could say physical death. Well, it's knowing physical death, but I would say because of what he's been looking at in terms of, he's been telling us to look to the future and look all the way, look up above the horizon. I think this is talking about spiritual death and eternal death. That sin, if not dealt with, will lead you to eternal death. Okay? And that tells you something about the person who we're talking about here, that their failure to deal with their own desires, their own lusts, their own sin, will reveal the true nature of the heart. is an unconverted heart. Okay? Yeah. To follow your commands.
To follow you can only come from you.
Yeah.
And just yes. Everything we're talking about makes me think of
right.
That.
And you know, going back to the Lord's Prayer. I mean, why pray if it's all on you, why pray, deliver me from the evil one? Deliver me from evil. Do not lead me into temptation, but deliver me from the evil. Why pray that if it's just all on me? It's because it's all the Christian life is all a life lived by grace. We participate in that, but we depend on his grace. It's never all on us. But we do have a part to play in that. We do have to kill sin in our lives by the grace of God. I mean, it goes back to it's the end of the second psalm. I will slay my sin by grace and grace alone. I will slay, but by grace, right? It's always by grace. There's always a dependence on the Lord here. I think you get out ahead of your skis when you think that you're not needing to be dependent on the Lord there. But this is the picture.
What about 1 Corinthians 13, no temptation.
Oh, 10, 13, yeah.
It has overtaken.
Right, yeah. That's we'll have to reference that maybe next week because I want to bring this to an end here, but I do like what Hebert said he says James gives the story of three generations. The grandmother is lust, the mother is sin, and the daughter is death. And at any point in that, we have the agency to intervene in that process. That's the process, that's the pathology of temptation. It starts in the heart with desire, a desire that's drawn out by temptation and enticed to strike. And when it strikes, it's like the union that conceives a baby called sin. But even then, sin, you know, desire gives birth to sin. But even then, there's an opportunity to not let sin grow, to put it to death while it's still in its infancy. But when you let it grow full and take over your life, eventually it will give birth to death. And so this is the pathology here. This is how sin and temptation and desire works. And we have to know that. Otherwise, we're going to always look to somebody else, always feel like we're a victim, that are helpless in our circumstances. We've always being acted upon. I have no agency here. We have to understand how this works. And God, by his grace, gives us the tools to be able to deal with sin, to deal with temptation, to identify it. And ultimately, it does come down to a heart thing. I mean, we have to recognize that and be able to look at the things that we struggle with in life and look at those temptations or those sins that we have and what you can get better at and better at is tracing it back beyond the action or the word or the thought and tracing it to the heart. It's what we try to get at. What is the heart desire going on? What is sitting on the throne in my heart that I'm willing to do this or that or say this or that in order to have that thing that I want? That is how you grow. Yeah, and you had something there.
Well, I just was thinking we should remember to not be surprised by temptation.
Sure.
You know, we tend to try to become a better person.
Sure, absolutely.
We can get to feeling kind of good about ourselves.
Yep.
Because we're better than we used to be.
Yep. And that's where Romans 7 is really helpful. And we'll look at that a little bit too in conjunction with the next passage. But I want to let us go here. Thank you, Lord, for this time in your word. Thank you for the Just the analysis of each one of our own problems as we struggle to be holy in our lives. It is a struggle that we often fail, and too often we don't even recognize why. But Lord, by your grace, you've shown us where the true problem lies. It's not necessarily in the world. It's, although the world is evil, it's not necessarily with the devil, although the devil is certainly evil. It's our own hearts. It's our own hearts, and it's our own decisions and the desires that we have that we rise above the desire to do what's pleasing to you. And I just pray, Lord, for each one of us to be more aware of what's going on in our hearts, although we know that they're deceptive. But you search the heart. You search and know the heart. And you also do surgery on our hearts with a scalpel that is sharper than any two-edged sword. It is the scalpel of the word with which you surgery us and identify those things and pierce us through. And so we just thank you that you've given us those tools and that we are not alone in that, that we do this and we live the Christian life, we run the race by grace. May we slay our sin, run the race, and finish the race by grace.